they say about side effects.
You know what they say about side effects? Come and get them and collect them and trade them with your friends. This is We Have Concerns. Hi, Jeff Cannata.
Hi, Anthony Carboni.
Hello, concerned citizens. Who talks first this week? I talk first? You talk first?
You can go. I don't care.
Who talks first? Okay. I just can't remember who talked first last week. Hey, that's not what friendship and co-hosting is about. But
matter.
I do think it's my turn.
You can talk first anytime you want, my friend.
It's not my turn. You know how you can feel when people are staring at you?
Yeah, we picked the same story this week. This is going to be fun.
Shit.
I should have talked first.
You should have talked first. Two things.
Go
Two
for
things,
it.
Jeff. Number one.
Love this story.
Number one, you should have talked first. And number two, you should not have said yes to that question. You know how you can feel when somebody's staring at you. You absolutely cannot.
I absolutely can, dude. I have thought this. This is why I was so excited about this story.
There is no scientific evidence of this at all. And you just answered yes.
I agree that there's no scientific evidence. And I am usually somebody that is a skeptic and cries hogwash at the hootenanny. You know?
Yeah. You don't want to call don't cry hogwash at the hootenanny. A lot of people, it took a lot of work to put the hootenanny together. Everybody gets out of the barn.
I cry hogwash right there. I'll stand right in the hootenanny and I'll say hogwash.
No, Dibney gets to leave his job at the general store. Jebediah comes out from the fields. Everybody goes to the hootenanny. You can't call hogwash at a hootenanny.
Well, I'll do it. I'm that guy. Usually. Right. But in this case, I'm telling you, sometimes, too often, many times, in fact, I'll be driving in my car and I'll be looking over at the person in the other car. I don't know. They're in another car adjacent to me. And they all of a sudden turn and look at me. How did they know that I was looking at them? They didn't know they were driving. Same thing happens to me. My gaze will be pulled by somebody and I'll catch them staring at me in the other car. How did I know that? How did I know to turn and look?
How did you know specifically? Well, it's because of your amazing psychic abilities. You specifically, Jeff Cannata.
I think we as a species sometimes can feel being looked at.
Okay.
Sometimes.
We need to pull this apart because this is wibbly wobbly fucking. This is a fucking wibbly wobbly way to be saying this and to be discussing this, right? I think
yes.
We can agree on that. It's wibbly wobbly.
It's very wibbly wobbly. I don't like it, but I sort of
story,
feel it and I've observed it.
But we need to find out. We need to find out why, because this is bullshit. This was sent in by another Jay Martin at the Discord. Thank you for sending in your stories to the Cool Science News on the Discord.
Indeed.
And thanks for discussing Cool Science News on the Discord with other concerned individuals. It's a fun place to be. But this was a Scientific American. The title of the article is When Our Gaze is a Physical Force.
Mm-hmm.
And they are talking about the idea of somebody's look, somebody's stare.
Right.
Exerting a physical force that you can feel. It's called extramission. And it's been around. The idea of this has been around since. Well, at least Greek times is the first time we've seen it written and spoken about because, hey, as we all know, before that, people didn't write as much. But I have a feeling people didn't write as much, and it certainly didn't survive.
Well, it's the idea that when you look at something, you are doing something is coming out of your eyes. You know, there's you look out instead of what we know to be true in science, which is light is coming into your eyes and being interpreted by your brain.
But the idea is, yes, simply by looking at something the same way, touching something, carrying something, holding something. Right. This is when we were the Greeks were very into figuring out the physical reasons for things. Right. They were like, there are physical laws. We just need to know what they are. And so the idea is, well, if I'm looking at the thing, I am exerting my energy towards the thing. And if the thing is another person, certainly just like my tapping them on the shoulder, perhaps my looking at them exerts a much weaker touch, an energy that they can slightly feel, usually on the back of their neck, right? We talk about it being on the back of our neck. even though I rarely feel something on the back of my neck. I think we just default to that.
Yeah, I don't think I've actually ever felt anything, but there's this need to go and look at what somebody else is looking at, you know, or being looked at, feeling that you're being looked at.
So what causes it? Is it a physical force? No, that's dumb. But what causes it? You know, why do we know it? And there have been many studies about that. Why do we think it? Yeah. And there have been many, many studies about this. One of the first modern studies that I found when I was looking into it, because this is a phenomenon that I've been fascinated with for a long time. I actually consider this phenomenon one of the first maybe adult times I thought to myself, it's something that I think put me on the track of eventually becoming a science communicator and investigating. Like, really? You know what I mean? It was, this is one of those phenomenon where I was like, whoa, let's figure out everything we can about this. And there was a book called The Sense of Being Stared At by Rupert Sheldrake. And it's based on a paper that he had written called The Sense of Being Stared At, Confirmed by Simple Experiments. So I've been looking into this for a while. And because I too, I'm just like, it's weird. It's just too weird. And I have to know why it works. It's too weird for me to not know why.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I'm glad you acknowledge that it's something that people experience. Cause I feel like when I started talking about the thing in the car, you're like, no.
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, listen, they don't look over because they feel you looking at them. That's, I guess, what I'm getting at is we need to drill down into what makes them look right. That's what that's what we're wondering.
Yes. And
the first time this was ever sort of studied in an organized way was by a psychologist named Edward B. Titchener in 1898. He was a teaching professor and teaching psychologist. So he had some students that said that they could feel when they were being stared at from behind. And an even smaller portion of those students believed that by staring at the back of a person's neck, the neck specifically comes up again, they could force that person to turn around.
This is the old Jedi mind trick.
This is the old Jedi mind trick, which is real and is science. So... Titchener was like, hey, eat shit, kids. You're dumb as rocks. Let's run some experiments. This was so Titchener. He was kind of the bad boy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was kind of the bad boy of psychology at the time. He basically was like, no. There's no telepathic reason for this. Maybe when you're experiencing the feeling that you were being watched and turned to check, maybe the second person who kind of already had you kind of in the corner of their eye kind of clocked you actually looking at them.
Right.
Just a moment after you looked at them. And so they return your gaze and now you're looking at each other and each of you maybe thinks the other one caused them to turn and look.
And it's not even a conscious thing. It's a subconscious thing, which what makes it feel extrasensory, right?
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that we talk about a lot, which is all these wired connections we have for certain survival instincts that are not super great. Well, they are still super great for us, but they're not as super great for us as they used to be, right? Peripheral vision, man, you got it. Like anything sneaks into your peripheral vision, you have a tendency to look over because like peripheral trouble, something's sneaking up on me. Something's coming.
Yeah.
Like that's what our lizard brain thinks.
I'm about to get eaten.
I'm about to get eaten. Listen, I'm about to get eaten at this hootenanny.
I call hogwash at this hootenanny and now I'm about to get eaten.
This is some real, this is exactly the hogwash I was talking about. Y'all thought you'd come down here, do a do-si-do at the hootenanny. You can't do a do-si-do at the hootenanny.
That's hogwash.
There's danger. There's danger of the hootenanny. So they ran an experiment to see what was... Titchener ran this experiment. He was like, okay, what's going on? Let's have people focus their attention on their own neck and the thought that somebody might be staring at it. Or let's have somebody focus their attention on their knee or their foot and see if that makes that part of the body more sensitive to pain. And he conducted these lab experiments with people who claimed that they could sense the stares of others. And listen, they were invariably negative. The answer is no.
They never were able to do it?
They would listen. It could not be reproduced. You could not simply, he found in 1898, you simply cannot stare at somebody and they can feel it and they'd turn around. There's just no way. There's just well,
maybe
no
maybe back
way.
In 1898, they didn't stare right. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe it's a more modern stare that you need.
Yeah. You need sort of a, you know, sort of an aloof askance sort of look, which was not invented until, you know, the late 20th century.
An ironic stare.
It was created by Godard as part of the French New Wave. Before the film Breathless, nobody ever looked at each other that way. The French will say they did. But well, that's only because Godard was French. That's called confirmation bias, Jeff. And that's why we're an award-winning science podcast. So, but you read this too.
Yeah.
This story. And so you kind of looked into this. There were a couple other studies that were not really mentioned in this article. They kind of allude to them, but
it's fascinating though, this link that we intrinsically have as human beings between our gaze, our focused look and physical properties, like that we seem to, as a species, need to believe that we can affect things with our eyes. It's not even that we are consciously believing that. In fact, one of the studies in that story is they specifically selected people who do not believe that is possible.
Yeah.
And then tested them in a really kind of interesting way where they showed them a picture of a person looking at a thing and then a picture of the same person blindfolded looking at a thing and asked them to judge. It's this like tube.
Cylinder. So there were a couple. The one that you're talking about is there was basically a simple video game that they made, right?
Yeah.
And the idea is there's a tube on a table and there's like a guy, like a face staring at the tube. And they're like, okay, using the computer, tip the tube over to the point like where you think it's going to fall over entirely, right?
Yeah, it's so, like the tube that's left over at the end of a roll of paper towels or something.
Yeah, so they're like, hey, just tap at that tube and let us know when you think it's about to fall over. Like, put it at the angle where you think it's going to tip. And they put like just this face of a guy. They called the guy Kevin. They put a face of this guy, this AI guy that they called Kevin, and Kevin's staring at the tube. And what's wild is when Kevin was blindfolded, people thought that they could tip the tube much farther before it would fall.
Yeah.
Than if Kevin was looking at the tube. Kevin is not real. The tube is not real. No one was told what the point of this experiment was. They were simply told, my guy Kevin is looking at you in that tube. Don't worry about that. That's just Kevin. He's part of the experiment. And if I was part of the experiment, I'd be like, why? What is Kevin about?
You just want to know more about Kevin.
I would just be like, listen, I know that I'm tilting a tube, but like, what is Kevin about? I want to know what their fake reasoning for Kevin was. You know what I mean? Like, I want to know whether it was. But anyway, the idea is there was something about Kevin staring, whether the people thought it was at them or the tube, that made the tube feel more precarious, as though it was going to tip faster.
Right.
Just by Kevin being there and looking.
Kevin exerts some physical force on it with his gaze on the tube.
Can I tell you what I think it is?
What?
I'll tell you what I think it is. We're so fucking nervous about other people and what other people think of us all the time. And I think we're so just, even if it's subconsciously, another person being around, maybe nervous is the wrong word, but somebody being around just affects the act of us being observed changes us so fundamentally that maybe on a subconscious level, we're just like, we feel like the tube is just, is just more precarious just because somebody's looking at you and you're like, oh God, they're going to see me knock over this tube. Or, oh God, they're waiting for me to knock over this tube. Or, oh God, really did I tap the tube enough? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think, honestly, I think it has more to do with, I think basically we're saying the same thing here, but I think it's less about worry and anxiety and more about we are social creatures so completely that mm-hmm. We are so in tune with the slightest little inputs that we can get. You know, we can in a glance see, interpret a facial expression. We are so evolved to interpret what other members of our same species are trying to think or feel that the direction that they're looking, the intensity with which they're looking that direction is extrapolated by our brains.
Yeah.
And I think it's the easiest way to decipher that data is our brain goes, well, it's doing something, you know, the gaze itself, the look itself is doing something.
Do you think, okay, the look itself is doing something. I interpreted, until you said that, I interpreted what you were saying as sort of like a, whether the Kevin face was changing or not, perhaps we are looking for some sort of micro change in Kevin's face that tells us he sees the tube is about to tip. You know what I mean?
We're waiting for that. We just keep waiting Kevin to tell us.
And maybe, yeah, well, like, because if I'm tipping, if I'm doing something, if I'm the one manipulating the tube, if I'm tossing a ball up and down into the air, I can feel the ball. I can feel my hand. I know how much force I'm exerting, right? If you're watching me, to you, there's more of a variable of, is that ball going to get away from him? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Like, and so maybe we're looking for something in Kevin's face and maybe we see it, whether Kevin's face changes or not, something that says that tube's about to fall. You know what I mean? Like maybe we're even just looking for confirmation from another face.
Yeah. Oh, Kevin doesn't think it's going to fall. I can keep moving Kevin, this tube.
I can keep moving this tube. Kevin doesn't know. Kevin, look, Kevin's so chill. Like Kevin's so chill. If Kevin thought the tube was going to fall, I'd know. Kevin wouldn't be able to, Kevin would lose his cool. So I think that's really funny. So this guy Sheldrake, that wrote the book, The Sense of Being Stared At.
Yeah.
They did a couple versions of these experiments. One where people were watching other people through closed circuit TV cameras. So there was even like another layer of abstraction. You know, can you tell when the person is looking through the camera and seeing you on the screen? When what's interesting about that experiment is it was about 50-50. It was exactly,
really?
Yeah, it was exactly random chance on that experiment. Sheldrake did do a couple other experiments, saying that he got like a hit rate of around 54% with two subjects being nearly always right, scoring way above chance levels. But, later on people kind of looked at the way he went about the experiment and they were like, you didn't really randomize this dude. You seemed to want them to be psychic.
It makes me think of the scene from the very beginning of Ghostbusters.
That's what I'm saying. He was Venkmaning. He was
totally
just
Venkmaning.
Like, yeah. He was just like, nope, sorry. That's not a star. That's a white. That's a wave. You know?
And then the hot chick, he's like, yeah, you got it right.
Yeah. So Sheldrake was basically Venkmaning is what they were saying.
Classic Venkmaning.
Classic Venkmaning. But the interesting thing about this new study that I really love is it's not so much about, are we going to turn around because Kevin's looking at us? That's not even a variable that's given to us. It's more, hey, you're doing something and you can tell somebody is watching you. Does that have a force, whether it's psychological or physical, right? Because I do think that we are attuned to knowing when people are looking at us. And there have been studies that say we can visually detect gazes. We can visually detect eye contact that is so subtle and so far away once it's in even the periphery of our vision, we're
don't they call that gazedar?
That's called gazedar, and some people have better gazedar than others. And I'll tell you, it's the real problem is the male gazedar.
Yeah,
because too much media is built around the male gazedar. But I think this is sort of more of that, like hardwired survival stuff, right? It's seeing a face in the electrical outlet or on the front of a car. It's like, hey man, you need to know when another living thing is around.
Right. It's very important for our survival to know when we're being stared at, potentially eaten, or a potential mate has decided to
all the way across the room. Maybe it's a fancy, maybe it's the scene in the movie where we're wearing a rented tux and we're a little uncomfortable. We've never worn a tux. And here we are at the fancy party. We look over, there she is, the beautiful lady.
Looking right at us.
We catch their eye.
This is what's been happening to me every time I drive my car, right? Maybe that person in the other car is my soulmate. You never know.
You never know. Do you let your wife know every time? Do you like, I might have found him today.
Honey.
I hope that happens for you. I want that for you.
She is.
You'll get him tomorrow, buddy. She says.
Yeah. Keep driving, honey. Keep driving.
As she tucks your two children into bed. but yeah, no, I think that sort of stuff is more likely, right? Like our human eyes, like, are actually like even more well developed to see those sorts of facial patterns and to be able to tell those sorts of contrasting details than some other animals that are less social and less required to do that. Some animals that are not as low down on the food chain or were as low down on the food chain, their vision sort of evolved differently. So I think this is basically when you pull up to someone in the car or pull up alongside someone in the car, I think a couple of things are happening. I think number one, they're looking for their soulmate the same way you're looking for your soulmate.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's got to be on. You got to be on call all the time in case soulmate drives up, you know,
you got to be ready for that meet cute. I'm always carrying a stack of books and walking around as many corners as possible. Well, you know what I mean? Just because I'm hoping somebody else stack of books.
Of course. And then you drop your books and you realize you were both carrying the same book.
Right, but like I also wind up with one of their books. They wind up with one of my books. Luckily, they're the sort of person that I am, and they still care about books and they care about book plates. So all of their books that they care about have like a little, if this is found, please return to. And that is like, you know, that's really what does it, is like, oh, somebody who cares about books as much as I do.
Anthony, this is why
tapping cars. Your car, you're always tapping other cars in the lane.
It's also why I always go to...
I'm sorry.
I always go to all the hootenannies, you know?
No, but here's... What better place to find
people than at the hootenanny, you know? I mean, I do call...
Jeff, I have to... I want you to find somebody, and if you want to find somebody at the hootenanny, I want that for you, but you do see the problem with your hootenanny strategy, don't you?
What's that?
You can't walk into a hootenanny where you're hoping to find love and call hogwash.
But that's...
You're the wet blanket at the hootenanny. Who are you going to meet at the hootenanny except for another wet blanket acting like that?
Well, that's what I'm trying to find my soulmate. I want to call hogwash the same time somebody else calls hogwash, and there we are.
You want to find somebody who's as little fun as you are.
Yes.
You want to find, you're looking for like maybe John Lithgow in Footloose. Maybe that's who you're looking for.
Yeah, this is why I look when I'm driving and when I'm calling hogwash at hootenannies. That's the only time you can play, only places you can find people that are as, you know, boring.
But here's what I do think is happening, though, is I do think, number one, when we're driving, we're all driving. I mean, look, we're all, even when, look, you're supposed to be paying attention when you're driving. Can we all agree on that? We all
paying attention to my future, paying attention to my destiny, Anthony. Yes.
Yeah. And also the road sometimes.
Well, sometimes. You're talking about the long road that stretches in front of all of us that leads us invariably to our soulmate.
Yeah. The long and winding road to their door, as Mahatma Gandhi once said. So I think because we're all in kind of a heightened state, I think people tend to feel this I'm being stared at, not the power of somebody's gaze that they've already caught. I think the idea of I can feel it on the back of my neck or whatever, that somebody's staring at me. I think that comes more during times when we are on guard, nervous, a little embarrassed, a little out of feeling a little out of the flow, even a little bit. You know what I mean? I think that's when they happen. And certainly when we're driving, we're all kind of on that, even if it's subconscious. You know, that subconscious thing that like you drive home, but you know that you stopped at every stop sign on the way home and you're like, damn, what was the drive home about? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. You don't even remember it. Yeah.
You can do that. But if somebody gets into your lane, even when you're in that state, if somebody goes to cut you off, you immediately snap back. Usually some people get into accidents, but most of the time I snap back into it. I'm like, oh God. Yeah. I was paying attention. Physical me was paying attention to driving. And now mental me is paying attention because I saw that just that little movement out of the corner of my eye. So I think when somebody kind of pulls up alongside you, you're using your peripheral vision, you're using all of those senses, and you're kind of a little bit on the defensive. And so when somebody pulls up alongside you and looks at you, I think you're maybe catching it out of the periphery, you know?
I think that's probably true. That's what I've always assumed was happening, was that I'm hyper aware of this. I'm built as a human being to be hyper aware of when anyone's gaze catches me. And so there is some subconscious part of me that picks up on that signal. There's some part of me that I'm not even aware of that is always wondering or always on alert for when that might be happening. And so my conscious brain just kind of catches up sometimes. Like somebody will be looking at me and I'll turn and look at and we'll make eye contact car to car, and it won't be my soulmate, and I'll be disappointed. Mm-hmm. But
sure,
you move on, and then sometime later, it's not really about the soulmate anymore. The idea is that I think that it is a natural process that my conscious brain isn't aware of.
Yeah. And I just want to say also, I think it's great that you said it's not about the soulmate anymore, because I think you're only really going to find love when you're not looking for it so much.
Like, you know, my wife sitting next to me on the passenger seat.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think your wife would tell you the same thing.
Cause sometimes I have to look past my wife.
Oh, usually
through the passenger side window to see the person I'm making eye contact with, you know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So I don't know if there's some metaphor that we can come up with there for literally looking past my wife.
Can I tell you, when you tell me this, if I can be honest,
yeah,
I think it's your wife that's getting in the way. I think she should lean back. Just lean the seat back a little bit.
Just lean the scene back. Yeah. I always tell her to relax, you know?
Yeah. Just relax and let me, I'm never going to find love if you're always on edge.
Yeah. Or she could sit in the back seat with the children.
Sure. Sure. Maybe then they'd be a little quieter too, and you could ignore them as well. I don't know why she's not thinking about you more. If I can be honest, I wonder why your wife doesn't want you to find love.
You know what it is?
If she really cared about you, I think she'd want you to find love.
You know what it is, Anthony? She loves a good hootenanny is what it is. She's a delightful, fun-loving person who enjoys a hootenanny. And we've never seen eye to eye on that, you know?
Yeah.
I call
it eye to neck, and you can feel it. Never eye to eye.
Never.
Listen, regardless of what this conversation would make you think, we're good people.
Yeah.
We're good people. We're working hard every week. We're putting out a show, you know, we're looking for science. We're trying to teach people something.
Trying to prevent my wife from listening to these episodes.
That's all we have to do. Listen, and this is why we need your support.
Yeah.
At patreon.com/weHaveConcerns. Because what we need is that we have a goal right now. If we reach a certain number a month, we're going to create a secondary RSS feed that's just for Jeff's wife.
Yeah.
And it's so much better.
It's going to be
just for her. And it's only going to be the episodes that we picked out where Jeff is being positive and cool and a loving husband and father. And then she'll never know. And then we can keep the show going.
Yes.
For you.
It's
people.
A win-win.
It's a win-win.
We put both of the episodes where I'm being a good husband on that RSS feed.
And the other 638.
On the
public feed. This is a win-win. We need your support. Not just that, but this is the money that we use to do everything. This is, we don't put ads in this show. We don't do anything like that.
Why would we do that?
I don't even bathe. I don't know if that's something that you wanted me to not do, but I'm not doing it.
Yeah, that's how committed we are to not being influenced. But Anthony is not listening to Big Soap. You know what I'm saying?
No, I'm also not listening to the episode when we record it, but I want you to pay me to do it. So what we need you to do is go to patreon.com/weHaveConcerns. And in return, we're going to give you some stuff. We're going to give some stuff back, not just this show, which we hope you enjoy and we hope you find value in anyway, but also you get access to the Discord server for $1 or more a month where concerned citizens hang out, talk to each other, play games together, just generally vibe. It's a real vibe in there, Jeff. Would you say
such
it's
a vibe? You may find your soulmate. Who knows?
You may find your soulmate standing across a crowded Discord. We also give bonus audio, bonus episodes, hangouts, all kinds of wonderful things. Please go check them out. patreon.com/weHaveConcerns. Did you find another story while we were doing this? Because I got to tell you, you felt very engaged. And I don't think to a listener, I mean, maybe people who are watching the video version of this, like if they're one of the precogs, maybe they could see that you were looking for another story, but I wouldn't have been able to tell.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad. I appreciate that because I barely participated. I vaguely remember insulting my marriage a few times.
Yeah. The best episodes are the ones where you're on autopilot, buddy. Don't worry. Let me steer the episode into port. I'm going to do it safely. I'm going to do it beautifully. We're both going to come out looking great.
I very nearly just picked almost as a punishment for you. Somebody on the Discord. Actually, let me get the name here. Old nickname, you know, posted the story about Uranus leaking. I almost picked that, but you know what? Going with a different one. Hey, we talk a lot about Spider-Man, right?
Yeah, sure. Not just on the show, but just in life. I don't know how much we talk about Spider-Man on the show. Probably
we talk about Spider-Man quite a lot on the show. You bring up Spider-Man 2 frequently.
Well, Spider-Man 2 is an amazing film.
As well you should.
You know, back. Doc Ock is back, according to the rumors.
Oh, I can't wait. It's going to be a multiverse.
Molina's back, baby.
Yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to jump through time and space and dimensions.
I don't know what we're going to do, but
regardless of that, let's talk about the prophet Stan Lee.
Yeah.
And his scientifically sound creations of Spider-Man's Rogues Gallery. In particular, I would like to refer you to one, The Lizard.
Oh, we know Dr. Kurt Connors.
We know about Dr. Kurt Connors and his unfortunate loss of a limb.
He's got a whole family now, you know, in the Spider-Man comics. He's got a wife and kid that he made out of lizard.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's got a lizard wife and a lizard kid, and they live in the sewer together.
Wow.
Yeah. Peter and MJ come over for dinner and stuff in the sewer.
And I'm the bad husband?
Well, yes.
Okay. As long as we establish that. So, the lizard, we know Kurt Connors, we know the lizard, in an attempt to grow back his limb, he wanted to be like lizards, like geckos, like iguanas, who are able to regrow limbs.
Yeah.
And he experimented on himself trying to regrow back his limb. He went a little too far and became a full-fledged lizard with evidently a lizard family now. This is news to me.
Yeah.
It was all about the Spider-Man lore, but this is news.
With a lizard family, yeah.
Well, it turns out, as I said, Stan Lee Prophet, because this is kind of ish happening. What we've discovered is that alligators are now the largest species that can regrow severed limbs. We didn't know that alligators could do this for the longest time, but it has been proven. Wow. Alligators can reach 15 feet in length and weigh up to 1,000 pounds.
Yeah, they're big boys.
They're big. By the way, we should note, in case it's not obvious to everybody listening, big difference between alligators and crocodiles. Crocodiles are the big scary ones. Alligators are the big, not as scary ones. They don't really attack or eat humans.
You can tell by the snout. I grew up in Florida. You can tell by the snout, which is an alligator or a crocodile. Can I tell you something else about the size of alligators and the most impressive way to see an alligator, Jeff?
Are you going to Florida me right now? You're Floridaing me right now.
I'm going to Florida you right now. Are you ready for this?
All right, do it. Florida me.
If and when you go to Florida, if you go to Orlando, specifically if you go to the Kissimmee region, the city of Kissimmee, which is where Disney World actually is. It's in Kissimmee. It's not in Orlando.
I feel like Kissimmee is a place that would have a hootenanny, you know?
Oh, Kissimmee had so many hootenannies back in the day before the iron fist of Mickey Mouse came in.
Yeah, I have no doubt.
Now they have some hootenannies, I'm sure, but they're like Chippendale's Hootenanny Pancake Breakfast Jamboree, you know? Like, which is actually a real show, and it's great. It is. It's at River Country. It's amazing. You should go see it. There is a theme park, which I'll use the word loosely, called Gatorland in Kissimmee. Gatorland Adventure Park. And it is one of the saddest and weirdest attractions that you will ever see.
The premier gator-based theme park in lower 48.
In the entire Kissimmee region. But basically, you go in, and it's been around since like the 50s or 60s. I mean, it's one of these places that popped up, you know, real, real back in the day. And when you walk in through a giant plaster gator head, and when you get in there, they've got gators, they've got lizards, they've got all kinds of little animals on display. But the highlight of going to Gatorland is something called the Gator Jumparoo Show. The Gator Jumparoo happens 3 times a day, Jeff. It happens at breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Okay.
And the Gator Jumparoo Show is essentially, there's a tiny retention pond. I mean, it's a pond that they dug out, but it looks like a retention pond. And they release these gators into this pond. In the middle, there's like a guy who sits in like a little tower. And there are these two clotheslines that come out from the tower. And he's got a little microphone. And he's talking, "Welcome to the Gator Jumparoo Show." And what he basically does is he takes raw chickens and clamps them to the clothesline.
Oh boy.
Wheels the chickens out, the raw chickens, and just sadly jiggles the clothesline until the gators think the chicken's alive enough to jump up and eat a whole chicken at once. And let me tell you something, those gators jump up, and this man's sitting in a tower elevated, right? This is like 10, 15 feet. These gators jump up out. They get the chicken, they eat the chicken, the entire chicken, one chomp invariably. But some of these gators, when they jump that high, their tail is still in the water, Jeff. They're huge.
That's because they're big. They're big. They're big creatures.
Huge. They got to eat 3-4 of these chickens 3 times a day at least.
Man.
Gator Jumparoo Show. I highly recommend it.
Well, it's luckily that they got shows at every hour on the hour, right? So you got plenty of food for the gators, I guess.
Gator Jumparoo is 3 times a day, Jeff. You got to be there at the right time.
Our way of saying that these things can be big. 15 feet in length, 1,000 pounds.
We're just saying they're big. That's all.
Super big.
I hope you understand now.
And the tail, the part that we have discovered that gators can actually grow back, can be around 18% of their body length. 18%. Can you imagine growing back 18% of your body?
Yes.
Holy hell.
That would be amazing. I imagine shit like that all the time.
Like Kurt Connors.
That's one of the reasons we host this show is because we imagine shit like that all the time.
That's true. That's a good point. That's a good point.
I'm always like, oh my God, what happens if like one day, like, you know, I imagine like getting an arm cut off and it's just like one day you'll be able to go in and it'll be like the end of the beginning or the end of the Fifth Element. Where they build you slice by slice.
Yeah.
You know?
Ooh. Now, this is an article by the Smithsonian Magazine. No slouch, right? Smithsonian Magazine, you feel like is a pretty solid publication. There's a line in this article about how we've discovered about this about gators that says, Kenro Kusumi, a biologist at Arizona State University, received a package that contained only a small deformed alligator tail preserved in a pickle jar.
He grew an entire alligator out of it, and now they're best friends.
That's not really the part that I'm shocked about. I'm shocked that they don't give any more information as to why he received a package with a small deformed alligator tail in it.
Free shipping.
Anyway,
if it's free shipping, you might as well just order it. Yeah. It's free shipping. You just order it. You know what I mean?
They said further analysis revealed that the tail had grown back after it was severed. They used high-tech imaging techniques and traditional dissection, and they found that the tail regrew cartilage, not bone. So the thing that happens here is that as impressive
and
they're not the same. Like most creatures that can grow back their limbs, they are kind of sad versions of the original limb. It's not a perfect regrowth.
Right.
And that's the case with the gators as well. It is not a complete regrow. It regrows nerves, skin, and blood vessels, but not the full skeletal muscle. I mean, not the full skeletal form.
Did you know that there have been several studies, and if a young kid gets their fingertip cut off, like before the end of the nail, it usually just grows back, and it grows back pretty perfect.
Really?
You gotta be a little kid. I think we're talking like toddlers, but yeah.
Well, lizards actually do grow back their skeletal muscle.
Lizards do this shit all the time. Lizards are looking at alligators and kids' fingertips and they're like, get wrecked.
Right. Exactly. But there was no regrowth of the skeletal muscle in the alligator. It says regrowth of the tissue is energetically expensive. And if you're putting all your energy into regrowing the structure perfectly, you're deviating energy away from other more essential processes such as developmental growth.
Sense. That totally makes sense because for people like us, or I guess like any people, what I'm saying is the human animal, we got so many systems and subsystems and crazy shit going on that we're trying to do it all the time. Like it doesn't make sense for us in terms of what it would take for us to grow a limb back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? How long that would put us out of commission for so long. You're
18%
lizard.
Of your body length. It feels like that would take a while to grow back.
Like meanwhile, and this is just me guessing, and you can tell me if this is close to correct, but like a lot of these lizards, they can chill out perfectly still for real long periods of time. They don't expend tons of energy if they don't need to.
Right.
So maybe, or these alligators, maybe they're the same, these amphibians, where there's just kind of like, hey, I'll just chill here for 3 days, wait for my tail to grow back. How long does it take to grow back? Weeks.
Well, the thing that they've found with the gators is that this is mostly something that is possible in adolescent alligators. It turns out that young alligators are basically the prey for a whole lot of things. They have a lot of natural predators. So while a big ass alligator may go and jumparoo and get those chickens and be pretty, pretty big and scary, little baby alligators, they get eaten all the time by all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, they're cute.
So it's very,
you can see baby alligators at Gatorland too.
I don't doubt it. When they bite you,
because if they have little baby gators at the time when you go to Gatorland, sometimes they'll let the little baby gators bite your finger. It's like velvety soft.
I don't believe it.
It's like velvety soft, dude. It's
they don't have
weird.
Gator teeth yet?
No, they ain't got nothing, man. They're just like, and they're like, oh, it's adorable as hell. They'll hold this on feels for like dear a, life.
This feels like a Tiger King situation. It feels very abusive.
Gatorland has got to be a real Tiger King situation, if I'm honest. It's got to be a real Tiger King situation, but it's still open. It's still open after all these years. I don't know.
I wonder how they're doing in the pandemic. I wonder how Gatorland's doing. Anyway, so it is very evolutionarily beneficial for the gators at a young age to be able to grow back. Like, you know, if someone's trying to eat me, you just eat the old tail. I'll grow it back. You know, it won't be perfect, but I'll grow it back. But at least I can get away and still survive. That's the important part.
Well, because, I mean, then the tail is, listen, am I assuming correctly about alligators? But they're cold-blooded, right? They got to chill in the sun. Yeah. They chill in the sun all the time, right? Yep. I'm remembering my gator correctly. I mean, that serves so many purposes, right? Like, an animal goes to bite you. They just get a mouthful of tail. Tail is not necessary, but tail also adds a lot of good surface area for sunning. Plus, when you get older, and I'm being serious, you can absorb a lot more sun and heat through the surface area of the tail. It's like nature's solar cells. Plus, when they get real big, they'll whack you with that tail. And then it's also a weapon. Tail is great.
True. You gotta love tail.
Tail serves so many purposes. Big fan of tail.
I've always been a tail man.
You tell your wife that all the time when you're in the car.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the interesting part. We know that some dinosaurs, which are the ancestors of both alligators and birds, had the ability to regrow new limbs.
And therefore the only species that can broker peace between the two.
Yeah, that's why we need to bring the dinosaurs back.
That's what
we
have to bring
just
them
to
back.
Sit down and have a conversation. So at some point, about 250 million years ago, these two lineages diverted. And we got birds that can't grow back shit. And we got lizards that can still retain the ability to grow some stuff back. So alligators kind of diverged on that path, while birds, totally useless in the growing back category. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Huh. I wonder what happened to the physiology of the bird that made it so they couldn't grow things back.
Exactly. That's the question that the scientists are raising, which is when the evolution was this ability lost, and what happened? Like, why would they lose that ability if they have common ancestors?
Yeah.
The most chilling part, though, of this article in the Smithsonian Magazine is the one that made me think of our friend Stan Lee and his creation, Kurt Connors. I'm assuming that's Stan Lee creation.
Ditko. Lee and Ditko.
It's Lee and Ditko, right? Yeah, it's an old OG Rogues Gallery.
Although as much as we love Stan Lee and rest in peace and pour one out for the great Stan Lee, boy, he would have had you believe it was a Stan Lee creation. You know what I'm saying?
No, I know. I know that. Yeah, I know enough about
Ditko
the history.
Ditko would be the first person to tell you that. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. So this is the quote from Gene Wilson Rawls, a biologist colleague at Arizona State who is doing this research. Quote, "If this very large, long-limbed animal has this ability, can we take advantage of this to help people who have lost limbs or burn victims who need skin regeneration?"
Oh, Gene, don't do it.
She's presenting the Kurt Connors stratagem here. And I would be the first to want this for anybody that's lost a limb or had a burn or scar that maybe could regrow back. But we've seen what happens here.
To paraphrase another Marvel property, Gene, no. Listen, you can't inject somebody with lizard or bat. We know that.
Yeah.
You do not inject somebody with lizard or bat. You do not try to create your own sun, especially in the middle of New York City where there's no room for a sun. Okay.
Yeah.
You don't smooch a lady by a farmhouse when there's a meteor shower going on. I don't really understand that. So I'm still a little soft on that, but, listen, you can't do these things, Gene. I want it too. I want it too. I want to be able to regrow. I want to be able to like, I'd love for the human body to get to the point. I'd love for medical science to get to the point, Jeff, where like, I don't know, man, maybe things are so wild that like you could axe fight with a friend for fun, knowing that even if one of you lopped off the other one's arm, it would just regrow. You know what I mean? I'd love to see the human animal get there. I'd love to have an axe fight.
Can I tell you that would finally make a hootenanny worthwhile if you could have axe fights in the middle of a hootenanny?
They'll throw axes at a hootenanny, but they'll throw them at targets. They don't throw them at people.
Yes. Throw it right at my shoulder. Come on.
One time a few years ago, man came by in a covered wagon, very colorful, and he would throw axes at people at a lady on a wheel. Now that was something.
But
that
he purposely missed. He purposely missed.
He purposely missed, and he said it was skill, and we wanted blood, and there's nothing wrong with our small town. I would love to see us get to the point where we don't have to worry about stuff like that, Jeff. I want Gene's future.
Yeah, I do too.
You know,
but we've seen the warning signs from Lee Ditko.
Yeah. Have they found anything that they believe is this crucial difference between bird and lizard? Do they have any hints, any clues, or any tracks that they're going down at this point?
No, but I'll tell you my theory, because I've done
tell me.
You know, giving a cursory glance at this article.
Listen, we're not scientists, but we have a podcast.
Having prepared a different article and then rapidly read this one.
Yeah,
I do have some ideas, some theories.
Yeah,
I'll put them forth right now.
Okay.
I truly believe that, well, at least it seems to me, that when you have an animal that is long, like a lizard, and has a big tail kind of hanging off the end of it.
Keep going. I love where this is going.
Where predators are trying to grab it, reach out and capture it to eat it.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of you that's just hanging at right out there.
Yeah.
Vulnerable. I think evolutionarily, the ones that can get rid of that and grow it back survive, right?
That's what I'm saying.
So if we as human beings, the problem we have with you as human beings is we don't have enough hangy bits, right? If you want to kill a human being, you know this, you've wanted to kill lots of human beings.
Sure.
If you want to kill a human being.
But I never have. As far as we know,
there's no part of them that's hanging off that you just can get and miss the rest of them. Right. You're not you go for the center. You go for the neck. You go for the torso. You know, there's no hangy bit off that like nobody just misses and gets the leg. Right. So evolution doesn't say, hey, we need a new leg.
You're saying that the tail of the lizard is a sort of like a woohoo over here. Distractionary tactic.
I'm saying that we're a victim of our own physiology in the sense that we're just shaped wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If we were shaped differently, we would have the ability to grow stuff back too, because it would just make more sense. It would just have worked, right?
Now,
if the tiger in the cave with the Cro-Magnon could have reached out with its big paw and grabbed just a little bit of us, and we could have gotten away if that little bit tore off. We would have evolved to let that little bit grow back. But unfortunately, when the tiger reaches out his big paw, he gets our neck or our torso or some part that's just not going to grow back. You know, it's vital.
What about the tiger who catches you by the toe? And then you catch the tiger by the toe.
Well, then you have to let him go.
Only if he hollers. Now, listen, if the tiger gets you, on the leg, leg don't grow back. You can hop away, but leg don't grow back.
Show me a tiger that tries to get you by the leg. Your leg is underneath you.
Tiger's not going to try to get you by the leg, but you're running away. What's the last thing that's within reach?
Like,
foot. Foot is within reach.
If we ran by sticking our legs out behind us,
trailed. Jeff.
No, not like
you've
a,
always
not like
got
a
one
tail
of your legs
of a lizard
sticking out behind you. No, it's not like the tail of a lizard. Certainly not. But I would argue that makes us just harder to catch. I understand what you're saying. We're like the lizard gets his tail bitten off. It's like, ha, fuck you. That tail didn't mean anything. But
exactly.
Like, isn't it better not to have
me?
Isn't it better not to have the tail at all and be harder to catch?
Well, you just talked about how great the tail was. You can use it as a weapon. You can sun yourself and get all those sweet.
Yeah. But only when it grows back and only when you're cold blooded.
It's got uses.
It's got uses. I remember reading that we were built to repair quickly, not completely. Like we had evolved to if we get a big cut, our cut heals, like our blood clots, we scab over quickly. We don't necessarily heal perfectly because we were meant to move.
Yeah,
we were meant to run. We were meant to get back up and get going again and not do it perfectly. Whereas some of these other animals were built, like we're saying, if you're a lizard, hang out in a tree for a couple days, buddy. Let that tail grow back. They don't need to eat as often if they're not moving, right? That's one of the great things about being a cold-blooded animal, right? You can sit and slow your body down, chill out, heal the tail.
Maybe that's the problem, is they all hung out in trees too long and then they decided to be birds.
Maybe. You know, that's probably the way evolution works. And I would dare anybody to prove us wrong. I wonder if there's something to do with and this is just me cursory, like I don't know anything about anything, but the idea of, I'm also interested, and anybody who knows a lot about animals, particularly birds, can tell us. I'm interested in how quickly birds heal and how completely birds heal when they're injured, just because, and this is stupid, and this is such a child's knowledge of things, hollow bones. How much cartilage do they have? You know what I mean? How many stem cells do they have? What's it like for a bird to heal?
Right.
You know, and now that they have these light and hollow bird bones.
Yeah.
Are they still able to
think about that kind
heal?
Of stuff all the time. You think about like a horse, you know?
Constantly thinking about a horse.
Your horse breaks its leg. You got to put the horse down. There's no repair in the horse. Right. How does that how does that species survive? Right. If you break one part of it, you throw all of it into the garbage. Right.
Yeah. It's a waste of a horse. So my question is, I guess something I've always wondered is, how easy is it for a horse to break its leg, though, compared to a human? Do they got strong? They got strong trunks.
Maybe. But I've seen enough movies to know that, you know, they shoot horses, don't they?
I think that if there's a horse in a movie, the only way that horse survives is if there are two horses in the movie. You know what I mean? And then that horse has a 50% chance. But otherwise, somebody's got to kill that horse.
All I'm saying is, you know, Lee and Ditko never
can. Horse breaks its leg. Horse gets a horse disease. You know, like there's the only, that's it. If you got to have more than one horse in the movie,
you got to double up on your horses.
Otherwise you got 100% horse loss.
You don't want the horse loss. I'm just saying that Lee and Ditko never made a horse man, you know? There's a reason
it's a waste.
For that.
Well, because that's just a centaur.
That's true. If a centaur breaks its leg, do you have to shoot it in the head?
Yeah.
Never thought about that.
Yeah, that's the thing about a centaur, and that's the part they didn't show you in Harry Potter. Is that centaur later on after the Battle of Hogwarts was actually just walking around. Stepped in a hole, broke its leg. Ron Weasley had to shoot him in front of his children.
He shot him with the wand, though.
No, he had to use his wand to magic a gun and then shoot the
gun?
He magicked a gun, which, by the way, man. Listen, I don't know why somebody didn't just magic a gun in that first one. You know what I mean?
Helped a lot with the Voldemort, I feel. You know?
Let me tell you something. You put one gun in there and Harry Potter doesn't happen.
Why don't you just magic a bazooka? You know,
seriously.
Just don't even stop a gun.
Man, when I was 7 years old, I thought about magicking a bazooka. Come on. And this kid's supposed to be the greatest wizard that ever lived. Get wrecked. I would have magicked a bazooka on day one, you idiot.
You'd be like, oh, we can't say his name. Oh, really? I can say bazooka right now.
What if I say, I'm going to say his name. Hey, Voldemort, get over here because I just magicked a bazooka. You idiot. Anyway. Alligators.
Oh man, my new D&D campaign is going to be called "They Shoot Centaurs, Don't They?"
I find this stuff fascinating.
Me too.
You know, there are certain mammals that will like grow back, like in amphibians, like we're talking about, like in certain lizards and then amphibians. You know, just a single nerve can be enough for them to regrow a limb. Mice can regrow entire claws. So they think there's something to also the size and complexity of the animal that can cause it. Like the simpler the animal is, the easier it is to regrow entire structures. So I find stuff like this interesting, and I wonder, we're such unique and complex creatures, you know, even though our DNA is 99.9 whatever percent, you know, to other mammals, we are such uniquely built creatures, not just humans, but all other animals, that I wonder how easy it is to just, I don't know, take, you know, like crossbreeding two kinds of apple. You know what I mean? Like, I can't imagine that once, it can't be that simple. I wonder if it's even possible to do it going down this road, you know?
Right. Yeah. But I think there's things that we can learn. And certainly we've already, you know, put baboon hearts in people and things like that. So
yeah,
who knows
people, maybe one day you'll have a baboon heart and a lizard arm and you'll be able to fight with axes whenever you want. And that's why we vote.
That is why we vote. Ladies and gentlemen, that's an episode of We Have Concerns, an award-winning science podcast.
Oh boy. Hey, if you learned something, and even if you didn't, and especially if you didn't, because I have a feeling
especially if you didn't,
please do go check out patreon.com/wehaveconcerns and see if there's anything there that's worth your while. Give a little, get a little in return, and help support the show. And
we sure would appreciate it. Yeah. We would. That's the only way we are able to make the show. We are grateful to our patrons. We're starting the new year.
Start the new year, excited. Baby.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's make 2021, you know, better.
It's a low bar. Yeah. It's a low bar. Help us out. Give us a dollar.